The news story that has undoubtedly dominated the media across the world this week, at least until yesterday when things kind of exploded a little bit in Russia, wherever that is going. The news story prior to that was the tragic loss of a submersible in the Atlantic, which Richard's already alluded to. Ironically, that submersible was carrying passengers to the wreckage, to the site of the wreckage of arguably the most famous maritime tragedy of all time, the Titanic. And it met its end just a few hundred meters away from it. And those events have raised an awful lot of discussion and emotional outpouring concerning those things. First of all, obviously, sadness, the loss of life, the waste of such talent. But also, perhaps, frustration at what could be argued as the recklessness, maybe the arrogance of such unregulated adventure tourism. But then some people are drawn to that kind of life, aren't they? Seeking to achieve what nobody else could. The three on board, three of those on board, I should say, including the captain and two of the passengers, are described as adventurers, as explorers. It's what they do. It's their DNA. It's part of who they are. And it's what drives them through life. And the other two passengers were people from a financial background who had the means to pay, to experience that kind of adventure in its extreme. And of course, there are people who live for that kind of extreme. They want that kind of excitement, and it's almost like a drug. And there's also that sense of being able to say, but I've done this, I've done that. And for some people, it's a bit like a drug, getting the next fix. Listen to someone who's just completed a round the world yacht competition. And very often at the end of it, a question is asked, what next? And the comments from the person concerned is, yeah, we'll see what comes. And you know, something else will be on the cards. It's about achievements. And achievements are really important to lots of people. In fact, across humanity, we celebrate our achievements. If you're involved in the music industry, the film and television world, there are awards, award ceremonies. They're televised nationally. We celebrate these things. If you're in the world of science or medicine, there are prizes, prestigious prizes awarded for excellence and achievement. And if you're involved in other areas, athletics, sport, we have medals to recognize our achievements. There's nothing wrong, is there, in celebrating our achievements? Well, personally, I think there is a discussion to be had about the merits of some of those accolades, and particularly when we consider what motivation might be behind them. The drive, the pride, the ego, the ambition, and sometimes the cost of all of that. But that's another discussion that we might want to enter into. But surely there's nothing wrong with us celebrating our personal achievement, is there? When it comes to faith, when it comes to us living out our Christian faith, actually, there is a bit of an issue. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. Because it can be more of a problem than you might at first imagine. I wonder whether, as God's people, do we take pride in our roles within the church? Do we gain status from our positions of responsibility, for example? Do we boast of what we've achieved as individuals or as a church? I find it really interesting when I speak to fellow ministers, when we get together as a gathering and we talk about what's taking place. And so often, the thing that is mentioned is what we are doing. We talk about the activities that are on. Oh, we're doing this at the moment. This is our program. We talk about what we are doing. And success, even in churches, often comes down to the activities that are being undertaken. And I wonder, how close are we getting at this point to actually boasting about those things and about concentrating and focusing on what we have done? If someone were to ask you to describe our church, what is taking place, I wonder whether those are the sorts of things that we might traditionally have spoken about. Well, we do this. This is how we meet. We talk about the things that we do. Is that what God would have us focus on? Here's my point. Our achievements are the way the world tends to focus. It's the wisdom of the world to recognize and measure quality and success. It's often the way that people describe, oh, he's this person, he's done this, he's achieved that. It's how we describe ourselves. We like to blanket ourselves in our qualifications. Those are the things that we use as a human measure. And sometimes as a church and as Christians, we use the same things when we're talking about ourselves and about our churches. But where is God in that? I've been reminded of Paul's words in the previous chapter from the one that Jackie's just read to us. This is what Paul said at the start of the previous chapter. Let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. And then speaking to the church at Galatia, this is what Paul was suggesting should be their focus. He said, may I never boast except of the Lord in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, through which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. If I've got something to boast about, it is the cross of Christ through which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. That's the emphasis that Paul shares to a church. Well, this week I read these words and they really struck home from the passage that Jackie read to me. No eye has seen, no ear has heard. Have you heard that phrase apart from this morning when we read it? Is that a phrase that's familiar to you? No eye has seen, no ear has heard. Actually, it's the title of an old hymn. It's the title of a song that Paul Baloche wrote back in the 90s. And even Hillsong, who seem to be writing lots of the worship songs today, have this as a key line in a song that they have written. And the words are usually used to express what is otherwise the inexpressible magnitude of God's love for us. The unmeasurable, the incomparable mystery of God's love. Those are the words that are often used. Of course, if we're trying to talk about God's love, if we're trying to truly recognize it in the words that we use, then there isn't a language that has words that are adequate to truly describe the love of God. When we use a word like love, we think in human terms, and already any words that you use are just not adequate if they're used to describe humans, to begin to describe God, we very soon run out of superlatives. The adjectives don't seem to have the bite, the strength that we need to truly represent God. What those songs are trying to convey, what the psalmists convey, what you and I in our praise and worship of God struggle to convey, is that God and his love for us is incomparable. It is matchless. It is otherworldly. It is beyond comparison. It is in a league of its own. And when Christians want to try to express that, to express the inexpressible, they often use this phrase: no eye has seen, no ear has heard. And I want to encourage you, first, just as we recognize that, to hold on and appreciate the magnitude of God's love. It's the core of understanding God. And then to express that, to begin to try to express the unfathomable mystery of what God has for you. Hold on to that. Express it. And if those words help, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, so be it. But you know what the interesting thing is? It's all fine to use them. Please get that. Be filled with awe and wonder. But that's not really what Paul meant. Nor is it what Isaiah meant, which is who Paul is referring to in 1 Corinthians 2. In that quote that he offers, let me put it onto the screen for you. Here's the original words that he's quoting from Isaiah 64, verse 4. Since ancient times, no one has heard, no ear has perceived, no eye has seen any God besides you who acts on behalf of those who wait for him. Who acts on behalf of those who wait for him. That's what no eye has seen, no ear has heard. It isn't the wonder or the mystery of God that he's conveying, but it's how God uniquely relates to us. The one thing that no one has ever seen or heard before or since these words were written is any other God who acts like the God of God's people, Christians, who is living and acting on behalf of those who wait for him. And that's a line you can read and dismiss as, yeah, so what? Then let me just open it up a little bit and explain the magnitude of what this really means. In a world where there are many claims of gods and deities, there is only one true God who is a living God acting on behalf of his people. And in this, he is unique, absolutely unique. Unlike all other gods, the characteristic of the God of Christianity is this, that he works while his people wait. That's what that last line is on the screen. God is the one who works. God is the one who acts while his people wait. And in every other faith, every other religion, it's the other way around. False gods do the waiting. They do the distance thing. while their people work. Those deities, those gods remain at a distance, unapproachable, silent, demanding that their people work, trying to do the things that will qualify them for something better in the future. Buddhism, requiring their people to fulfill acts of kindness, to live in a particular way, and woe betide you if you don't fulfill all those things, or you get it badly wrong, because you're going to come back as a cockroach. Islam, whose holy scriptures are the Quran, which means recite, reciting, saying again, repetition, speaking out, read, 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 do it, again and again and again. That's the requirement of their faith, is to do these things. And you could apply it to us and any false gods, any idols within us, whereby achievement and success is the thing that we hold so dearly, even in the church. Because those idols will be just the same. They will sit at a distance, they will say nothing, and they will demand that we do the work. We work at it, we seek achievement, we seek more. And do you know one of the things that happens when people do something amazing? They've got to get that rush again. So they have to do something even more extreme, because it never satisfies. Those false gods sit at a distance, whether they be idols in our lives or false gods of a religion. They sit unapproachable in a distance, making their demands, seeking to be impressed. And the people do the work. Isaiah says something completely different. As usual, the God of the scriptures that we read turns everything on his head. It turns it all upside down. And Isaiah says, it is the true God of this world who works while we wait on him. Human beings try to put people center stage while God watches on. And the good news, the message of Jesus, demonstrated in the life of Jesus so clearly, is that God invites us to look on while he does the work of salvation. That's the God that we have, who says, no, you wait on me. I'm going to do this. And it's the message of Isaiah, and it is the message that is consistent through Isaiah. Let me read to you some verses from Isaiah 59, verses 15 and 16. The Lord looked and was displeased that there was no justice. He's looking at the world. He's looking at the fallen, broken humanity. He saw that there was no one, not a few, not a few wonderful people, but no one. He was appalled that there was no one to intervene. So his own arm achieved salvation for him, and his own righteousness sustained him. And a few weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago, was it, we read Isaiah 53? I'm trying to remember, was it on a Sunday morning, or maybe it was a Thursday morning in our prayer time that I spoke about it? Isaiah 53, the suffering servant, God's servant king, Jesus, the arm of the Lord will do this. That's Jesus. That's the good news of the Christian message, that is the core of who we are. The king who became a servant, who became a lamb. Jesus is the Lamb, the arm of the Lord who did this. And that's why Paul says, I will never boast except in the cross of Christ. That's the difference between our faith and any other. God is living and he is active, and he invites us to watch, to wait on him as he does it. And he did just that in Jesus. He acted in Emmanuel, God with us. Jesus stepped down into this world. He gave up his rightful place in glory, and he stepped down into this world, the Son of God. And he lived the life that we should have. He did it for us. And then he died, and he took on the punishment and the death that we should have endured. He did it, the sacrificial Lamb of God. And then he rose into glory and continues to intercede for us, the great high priest. God is the one who did it all, and he did it through Jesus. What is the place of us boasting about our achievements? There isn't one, which is why the Apostle Paul said, I will boast in nothing but the cross of Christ. God does the work. We do the waiting on him. And I was reminded of that step that we took 7 years ago, when God called us to stop being busy and wait on him. And as I read these verses in the last couple of days, it just hit me like a brick. I've never in my life had so much grief from people, including Christians, for daring to stop being busy. My goodness, we get so much status, so much satisfaction from what we do. And at that time, we were a small church punching well above our weight, involved in activities with lots of different people. We clearly heard God say, stop being busy, come and wait on me. And some people left the church because they weren't happy with that being the balance. People walked away. One person said to me, you know, I came to this church because you were busy doing things. The irony was that particular person wasn't involved in doing any of them. They just liked the idea of us being busy. And so many of us were burned out. Isn't it interesting that God says, I bring salvation, you wait. It doesn't mean we do nothing. It means that the things that we do come out of the waiting on him. Our time spent in his presence, recognizing, as that song this morning spoke and said, break our heart, for what breaks yours? It comes as we wait on the Lord. If anyone asks you why you believe, if anyone asks you about your faith, what sort of a church are you? Tell them. But don't say we do this and we do this, we meet on Zoom and we go and we have this and with this age group. Tell them what kind of a church we are. We're the church that knows, that believes that Jesus is the Son of God, who stepped down from glory and came into this world and gave himself to die on a cross and take upon himself those things that are wrong in me, those sins, those things that keep me from God. And he took them. And in exchange, God gave us the righteousness of Christ. He clothed us in righteousness, gave us an eternity and hope for an eternity in future. This is the God that we believe in. This is the kind of church that we are. A God who believes that Jesus is still working and interceding and doing amazing things in people's lives. This is the God that we can boast in. This is not about us boasting ourselves and, do you know what, we're going to come a cropper. I suspect maybe somebody found that out in Russia and boasted a little too much yesterday. This is what our God does. And that is the thing that we boast about. I've said to you before, the whole of theology really boils down to two questions. What kind of God? So what? What kind of God do we have? So what is my response? If we begin to boast of our response or to claim that we've got these things right or we do these things right, I wonder whether we need to go back and begin to look again at just what it is that God has done, the magnitude and how much further he went before we ever claim anything, and come back to what kind of God. He steps down. He serves. He suffers. He dies. And he does it for us. And that's why I cannot boast in anything I do for him. Because it doesn't begin to compare with what he's done for me. But I will boast in the cross of Christ. No eye has seen, no ear has heard of any God like this, who does all of this for his people. Now that's a God that we can boast in. Let's pray.